Here on this seat, may my body shrivel up. My skin, my bones, my flesh may dissolve. But my body will not move from this very seat until I have attained enlightenment. So, so that was the Buddha's great vow. So, we've just been doing, as Vidyavakshin said, we just had a week here on retreat, looking at the Buddha Akshobhya, the unshakable. And this is the Buddha Akshobhya at the back here. And he's a representation of that quality of unshakableness that the Buddha exhibited at that time. I mean, throughout his life as well, but particularly at that time, it's really apparent. And prior to this, the Buddha-to-be had a real spiritual quest to understand the nature of existence, the nature of suffering, the nature of dukkha. And for many years he'd practiced and learnt from other teachers, and undertook really severe austerities to try and understand the nature of this. So there's quite that element of sort of tenacity about it, that drive. So he finally sat down under a tree on the banks of the Narajana River. And he vowed to not move from that spot until he was enlightened. So that's quite something. And there's two accounts of what happened then. There's an account which is in some ways the great myth of the victory. That's like this big sort of drama that plays out with these personified forces. And then there's a sort of another account of his experiences and his internal experiences that are occurring while he's sitting there. And I was sort of reflecting on this, and really, like, both of those are necessary to think about in terms of the experience. I think, you know, the Buddha said that reality can't really be completely comprehended rationally. So we really need that sort of that myth, that story, in order to help us get to that visceral experience of what that struggle might have actually been like. Go slightly beyond that rational account. But at the same time, the Buddha also said that he did link this myth to his own experiences as well. So I think it's useful to look at both of those accounts of this this great struggle and the consequent great victory. So in the myth, in the drama, what you have is you have this embodiment of evil represented by Mara, this demon Mara, and you can he's described as the Lord of Death. So he pervades over this kingdom of samsara, or like the conditioned existence, the world of constant rebirths and sufferings that are associated with that and re-becoming over and over. So you could literally look at him as a force of evil in the world. You know, that is probably quite evident. We can look around and perhaps see the force of evil amongst us at times. But we can also think of him as the embodiment of all our destructive emotions. So particularly our doubt, unhealthy desires, and things like that. So basically, he's also sort of like all the things that hold us back. So you could also think of him as the Lord of Limitations. So in some ways, the great victory is about the Buddha overcoming Mara, overcoming this Lord of Limitations. So to some degree, defeating Mara is about overcoming oneself. Or for the Buddha, it was all about overcoming his sort of oneself, his all the things that hold him back. And so Mara is, as I said, particularly associated with doubt. So it's said that while the Buddha was sitting under this tree, Mara appeared and started to whisper in his ear, saying, "Oh, you're so thin and pale. Why do this? Why risk your life? Why not just go and live a comfortable life of pleasure? That would be a much better use of a man like you." But the the Buddha sat there and was unmoved by these whisperings. And so Mara wasn't alone. So he also is the head of a great army. And so the myth says this army is made up of twisted and deformed demons. Some of the really graphic accounts say that they have twisted, deformed faces, are covered in blood and spewing vomit. So, you know, not a nice bunch of people, really. So, one way of looking at these is they're all the personifications of different negative emotions that we have. And probably, you know, quite a wide range of them. So, you know, you've got things like anger, hatred, fear, terror, perhaps ambition, selfishness, ignorance. And, you know, all of these have got a slightly different character. You could imagine the big ogre of hatred that just wants to smash things. And you might have a sort of a more sort of snivelly, conniving character of ignorance or ambition or something. So, you know, a whole range of different manifestations, different creatures and demons. And it's said that they assailed the Buddha with their weapons. They threw rocks and sticks and arrows and slings and all sorts of things. And there's this beautiful image of the Buddha sitting there, completely serene, surrounded by an aura. And as these projectiles hit the aura, they transform into flowers. So that's a really beautiful image, which you might be familiar with. But so suffice to say, this attack didn't move the Buddha either. So, yeah, he hit there he was composed. And so Mara tried a different tact. So another familiar set of characters in this story is Mara's daughters, which are meant to represent, I think, the more seductive emotions that we have. So apparently they're named craving, lust, and discontent. They came along to try and move the Buddha, to sway the Buddha, but again he was unmoved. And interestingly, I haven't come across this one before, but I found another account which also has Mara's sons in it. So three sons, and the sons are named Flurry, Gaiety, and Sullen Pride. So what I think of these, I think of them as maybe like slightly arrogant princes, you know, who think they know best. Flurry, I think, might be sort of described as restlessness. You know, it comes along thinking that what you've got to do is more important than meditating, than practicing. Gaiety is like ebullient energy that's sort of like a bit shallow and insignificant that takes us away. And perhaps sullen pride is something like being a bad loser, stroppiness, or something like that. You know. So anyway, I find all these characters quite fascinating because I sort of recognise aspects of them in my own personality, in my own mind. So yeah, all of these characters assailed the Buddha, but he remained unmoved. And there's another episode there where he calls to witness the Earth Goddess as well, which I won't go into. There's a whole sort of myth around that as well, but it's at this point that arises. So if we look at the Buddha's account of his mental states, what he describes as happening is his concentration he deepens, and he becomes poised and focused, yet his mind is supple and responsive. So there's a lovely little description that I read you here, which I really like. Like a goldsmith, he prepares a furnace, heats up a crucible and places the gold in it with a pair of tongs. He blows on it, sprinkles water, and examines it again and again, so the gold becomes flawless, free from dross, malleable and luminous, and he can form it into whatever shape he wishes. So I really love that. It's kind of conjures up this sense of craftsmanship, you know, like a real mastery of the ability of moulding the mind, and the adoption of different tools and techniques in order to make the substance, in this case the gold, malleable and pliable. Very much, you know, he's using this as a metaphor for the mind and working with the mind, which I find really sort of fitting or sort of notice to some degree in my own experience. And so he, with this mastery, with this craftsmanship, he obtained a calmness of mind, like he described as a still lake. beyond pleasure and pain. So on the last retreat, we were looking at the loka dharmas, or the worldly winds, which you may have heard of if you've done any dharma study. And these are forces that blow us around. So they're like, you know, we seek pleasure and we try and avoid pain. We seek praise and we try and avoid blame. We seek gain and we try and avoid loss. So these things can draw us around and pull us in different directions. And the Buddha was saying he's in a complete state of receptivity, unmoved by these forces. You know, so another way of talking about that is saying that he was unshakable. And then he said that this allowed for him to open up to the sort of deepest, in all the darkest reaches of the mind, draw out all of his fears and lusts and hatreds and doubts. So you can imagine that if you are unmoved by these things, you can actually quite objectively bring them up into your experience and examine them for what they really are. So, with this, once he understood the nature and the relationship between these and his actions and in some ways the behaviour and ethics which bind us to seek things and push other things away, once he saw through this, he released himself from the bonds of having to behave like that again and again. You can sort of see that as, in some ways, that's the representation of Mara and his army in the myth. Like, overcoming these forces is him liberating himself from these drives to pull this thing towards him or push that thing away. In the ultimate sense, and in this metaphor, you've got the weapons that turn into flowers when they meet the Buddha's calmness and the aura, sort of represent the reintegration and sublimation of those energies. You know, those all this energy that these forces of desire have for us, they're suddenly liberated and released and integrated into the personality. So yes, it was this point that he achieved this extinction from clinging to anything, giving him complete freedom, which is a state which is often described as nirvana, the liberation. But often it's talked about that was the moment of his great victory. But I was just thinking about this and thinking, yes, so although he achieved irreversible enlightenment at that moment, he defeated Mara, he overcame that. The stories say that he actually stayed around the area where he was enlightened for between about 7 or 9 weeks. The accounts differ slightly. And just sort of like in some ways having that experience percolate through him and reaching a deeper and deeper understanding of what had been accomplished. So although he sort of, there was a moment of victory, I think it took a while to fully dawn, as it were. And there are lots of episodes which happened during this time, but three sort of key aspects that come out are that the first one is that he reported a great deep gratitude for all around him, so not least the Bodhi tree which sheltered him for that time when he sat under it, but also I imagine his previous teachers and his experience which led him up to that point. And often it's described that the Buddha decides to take this approach after having a vision of his father ploughing the field, sitting under the rose apple tree. So I imagine there was a great gratitude for his parents as well during this time. Secondly, there's a sense of real wanting to reverence and respect. So it's said that the Buddha looked around for somebody to revere and realised there was nobody that had achieved that level of consciousness and that he was at the peak of that, but yet he still wanted to revere. So he, after some time, he realised that he could revere the Dharma, the truth, the reality which he had realised, and that was a point of reverence. So, yeah, for me, this is like an extension of gratitude. This is like, appreciating what something has given you or somebody has given you. Yeah, and then finally, the other major aspect which comes out is that there seems to be a bit of a battle with himself about whether he could actually teach what he'd realised. So again, there's a myth around this where a god called Brahma Sahampati appears and tries to entreat him to teach the Dharma. But you could also understand that as him sort of trying to come to terms with how he could teach it, teach what he'd realised. And apparently this god Brahma Sahamati is supposed to have come to him and said, yes, but there are some beings with but little dust in their eyes, meaning that they can be taught, they could be taught. And it's said that the Buddha has this vision of this pool of lotuses, or the whole world of lotuses. Some of the lotuses are kind of in the mud, and some of them are raising up, and some of them are almost fully blooming out of the mud. And so it's at this point that he, in some ways I think the victory is really complete, because this is the moment when he journeys from the place where he had achieved enlightenment and walks to Saranath, which is a neighbouring village, to teach the four ascetics, four of his previous spiritual colleagues. So that's a sort of summary of some of that experience of the great victory. I think I tried to bring in a few different elements there, but I think the most significant thing for me was that the Buddha's immediate response to overcoming Mara was not a sort of pride or even a satisfaction that he'd accomplished that victory, but rather it was a gratitude and a reverence. I think that's what comes out most strongly. And I just, I just want to suggest that maybe those are the true signs of a victory. Mm-hmm.